If you are traveling north on Massachusetts Avenue in downtown Indianapolis, eventually you're going to hit the intersection of Walnut and Park Avenue and Massachusetts. And on the right side, as you're heading north, there's some large brick buildings, a large like brick smokestack. And on one of the brick buildings is a water tower that says Real Silk. Buildings are now condos, loft apartments, things like that. But over 100 years ago, this was a site of the Real Silk Hosiery Company. And today we're going to discuss a strike which hit that company in the 1930s. So welcome to episode 6 of Yesterday's Indianapolis, a podcast about the over 200-year history of the Circle City. My name is Ed Fujawa, and what I want you to imagine is, let's go back to Indianapolis in the early 20th century, when it really was a city of growth and industry. Not only its population was expanding, but manufactories of all kinds were sprouting up at various points around downtown, and the growing population was spilling out of the originally platted mile square of the city to various suburbs well outside the downtown core. And on the north end of Massachusetts Avenue was one of these large manufacturing complexes, the Real Silk Hosiery Company. So Real Silk was started in 1922 and occupied several acres of land just south of the intersection of College Avenue and Massachusetts Avenue here in Indianapolis. As the name suggests, the company manufactured women's hosiery, along with lingerie and various other undergarments. Financial trouble hit the company in the early 1930s due to the ravages of the Great Depression, and the company came under bank control. In 1932, Indianapolis-based businessman Gustav Ephraimson acquired Real Silk, adding it to his other business interests in and around the city, including department stores in the downtown area. While still a relatively young company, Real Silk would soon be subject to a very large labor dispute during the already tumultuous Great Depression years, when a large strike broke out at its Indianapolis plants in 1934. Now, Indianapolis is no stranger to labor disturbances and strikes. In the 1870s, there was the Great Railroad Strike, which took place across the country, but also impacted Indianapolis. 1892 and 1913 were very large streetcar strikes. It's actually been a subject of a book manuscript that I've been working on that I'm hoping to have published through the same publisher as did my previous book, Vanished Indianapolis, but we'll see about that. The 1934 Real Silk Strike was notable because it took place during the time period of the New Deal, a piece of legislation passed to address the Great Depression, and because it had bursts and outbreaks of violence between strike supporters, members of the company, and law enforcement. So the spark for the 1934 strike had its start in the already existing Employees Mutual Benefit Association, or EMBA, E-M-B-A, which was an employee organization already in place at Real Silk since the early years of the company's existence. The independence of EMBA was questionable because it had the support of management as almost a company-supported union. In September of 1933, the newly re-elected president of EMBA, Charles Leake, focused his re-election remarks on allegations from, quote, outside union organizers, end quote, that Real Silk was forcing its employees to violate provisions of the National Recovery Act, which was, again, a Great Depression-era program under which the collective bargaining abilities of unions was specifically protected. As reported in the Indianapolis Star, Leake came out swinging, stating, quote, our EMBA has in effect every provision of the code of the hosiery industry approved by President Roosevelt, and I can state the Real Silk Hosiery Mills is absolutely living up to every detail of that code, end quote. Apparently, most employees agreed with this, and on October 4th, 1933, the employees of Real Silk voted 2016 to 1054 in favor of continuing to be represented by EMBA, which the local newspaper Indianapolis Star described as, quote, a company union, end quote, as opposed to representation from the American Federation of Full-Fashioned Hosiery Workers Union, which is quite a mouthful, but and later on I'll just refer to them as the American Federation. So despite this election, union efforts to gain a foothold at Real Silk continued. In early 1934, two employees, Estelle Taylor and Nellie Savage, had their employment terminated for passing out union literature during working hours. Their termination was overturned by the National Labor Board, the NLB, in late March. Not long after, some of Real Silk's workforce, along with workers from two other local silk factories associated with Real Silk, walked out on strike on April 6, 1934. Union organizers asserted that the strike was to obtain union wage scales and the, quote, abolition of existing bonus and penalty system, end quote. Representatives of the American Federation reported that several hundred employees had gone on strike across the three plants here in Indianapolis, although management downplayed this, noting that, quote, only a small percentage, end quote, of employees had gone on strike. After a brief gathering of the strikers in the vicinity of the three plants, the strikers adjourned to the Eagles Hall on nearby Vermont Street to plan for picketing. Real Silk Management, of course, denounced the strike as a violation of the Employee Representation Plan, again, the IMBA election, which had been approved in October the previous year. Initially, the strike was peaceful, with picket lines being maintained outside Real Silk and the other striking factories. No picketing was done on the weekends, as the plants were closed on Saturdays and Sundays. Indianapolis Mayor Reginald Sullivan responded to the strike by redeploying police officers on traffic and school duty to the Real Silk complex. And apparently, Gustav Efremson was a close friend of the mayor and supporter of his campaign, which, like, facilitated that redeployment. On April 14th, the pro-union Indianapolis Times newspaper, one of the other major daily newspapers in the city, took issue with the lack of police in school zones when it ran a story about a young girl named Pauline Pierce who was struck by a car while crossing Massachusetts Avenue after school. Without the police officer usually posted at that location where she crossed for the safety of school children, the Times quoted Pauline as asking, quote, why wasn't a policeman there like he usually is, end quote. At the same time, the Indianapolis Times, on April 13th, ran a series of photographs about the strike under a headline that says, City School Children Dodge Cars as Police Guard Mills. And the photos are interesting. Some of it shows a few children standing on the sidewalk looking rather concerned about the lack of police helping them cross the street. There's also pictures of striking workers outside the factories. And then there's also a picture of a police officer standing with fine women who are wearing sashes that say, Strike. They all seem, some of them are smiling, they all seem rather happy. The police officer, not smiling, but he's certainly standing with them. On April 11th, 1934, a few acts of violence were reported with the strike. On that same day, the National Labor Board, which was supposed to enforce the collective bargaining provisions of the NRA, agreed to hear the strikers' demands, although sources are not clear if this decision was triggered by the violence. The Indianapolis Times reported that strikers were expected to prevail before the NLB, although a ruling in favor of Real Silk by the NLB would be binding on all employees. Either way, multiple strikers were arrested for intimidation of non-striking employees, as well as for the beating of a Real Silk employee while on his way from work a few days before. Real Silk responded by combining night and day shifts in order to try to better protect its non-striking employees from violence. The strike returned to a peaceful state for the next week, during which time employees at a Real Silk factory in Dalton, Georgia, also went on strike, demanding an increase in wages, although management viewed their actions as a, quote, sympathy strike with the Indianapolis mill. The Indianapolis Times, again, the local newspaper that supported the strike, threw its weight behind the strikers in a detailed editorial published on April 17, 1934, noting no signs of weakening by the strikers and, quote, no effort at conciliation by Real Silk management. The Times characterized the issue between the strikers and management as whether workers would have the right to bargain collectively via representatives of their choosing, and encouraged the public not to be confused or swayed by the full-page ads being run by Real Silk and the IMBA, arguing that the employees had chosen the IMBA over the union. And what these ads were, a public relations campaign by Real Silk management to explain their position. The Times also echoed union arguments that many who voted for the IMBA in October of 1933 were ineligible, including factory guards, cafeteria workers, and file clerks. The Times closed, noting, quote, we hope the strike is settled. Strikes are bad for the community, but justice is of more importance to Indianapolis than Real Silk's payroll, end quote. And that, quote, the labor problems at Real Silk can never be solved permanently until its management recognizes the right of labor to enjoy the benefit of real industrial democracy, end quote. At the same time, there was also an editorial strike cartoon, basically, and there's actually, I actually have a blog post about the strike, and I'll link to it, but trying to describe it, it says incongruous costume. It's a woman dressed in very fine clothing. On her back, there's a sign that says Real Silk Hosiery Mills, and it shows her dipping her toe onto a rock that says a modern product, while her dress says an antiquated labor policy, basically suggesting that the Real Silk management was stuck in the past and that in order to continue making a modern product, they would have to embrace the union and this more fair labor framework. So in the meantime, both sides, both the strikers and management, waited for the NLB to issue its decision while things stayed generally peaceful on the picket lines. This peace held until April 22, 1934, when George Madden, a Real Silk employee, reported a group of five men flipped over his car, which he had parked outside his brother's home on the near east side of Indianapolis. The next day, several fights broke out around the city between Real Silk employees and alleged strikers or strike supporters. In one instance, a group of four Real Silk employees claimed to have been stopped in their cars near the intersection of Fletcher and Shelby Streets by, quote, three loads of alleged strikers, end quote, who proceeded to beat the employees and damage their car. The perpetrators escaped before police arrived. And now this is one of those, I've seen this in other strikes, not only nationally, but in Indianapolis, especially the streetcar strikes, where you have the striking employees, but then you also have supporters or those who sympathize with the strikers who might not necessarily be acting on the union's behest, but are just there to make trouble, especially in the streetcar strikes of 1913. The police were condemning basically a bunch of rowdy boys who, gangs of boys who were downtown throwing bricks and who were causing a lot of the trouble or instigating a lot of the trouble. So with Real Silk, it's not clear, you know, they're saying alleged strikers. It's not clear whether these are actual strikers acting on the union's behest or if it's just some supporters or people who just want to cause trouble. Other violence also broke out in Riverside Park, where the Real Silk Company baseball team, who had been playing against another local team, became involved in a brawl with a group of striking workers who had shown up to the game. And this was a big thing. Back then, local companies would field baseball teams, and they would have basically, imagine like an intramural kind of competition throughout the city. And that's what was going on at Riverside Park. And on the night of April 26, there were several reports made to police by non-striking Real Silk employees of rocks and bricks being thrown through the windows of their homes by cars full of what they believed to be striking employees. Again, striking employees, strike supporters, or just some, you know, local folks who wanted to cause trouble. It's unclear exactly who was throwing those bricks and stones. On April 27, 1934, the NLB issued its decision for the Real Silk strike and rejected the union's request to bargain directly with Real Silk and not through the EMBA. However, the board recommended that the unions establish a limited term of 1 year for their representation, which would require another election in late 1934. So EMBA would only be in place for 1 year, then there would be another election to determine if the EMBA would represent the workers or if the American Federation. So this plan seemed to have stemmed from concerns voiced by the union and striking workers that the October 1933 approval of EMBA came as a result of Real Silk employees who, again, were not members of the EMBA or were not eligible to vote, which allowed the EMBA to win the election. William Smith, the secretary of the American Federation and their local official who was handling the strike, stated the union's view. Quote, "We feel that the National Labor Board did not give consideration to the seriousness of the situation, that the strikers are still determined, that they are not going to submit to any ruling which provides that their grievances are to be taken up with the management through the company union, namely the EMBA," end quote. As reported by the Indianapolis News, Smith vowed that the strike would continue and that, quote, "the strike is just beginning," end quote. Real Silk management argued that they could not interfere with the results of the October 1933 election and that each day more strikers were abandoning the picket lines and coming back to work. Prior to the NLB's decision, no efforts to settle the strike had been made, and subsequent to the decision, violence flared up once again. On May 1, 1934, a fight between several female strikers and non-striking employees broke out near the Real Silk complex just off Massachusetts Avenue. Additionally, a shotgun was apparently fired out of the fourth floor of the Real Silk factory towards the picket lines. One of the Real Silk guards, some of whom had been brought in from out of state, was suspected in the gunplay. The same guards were also reported to be roaming throughout the city, picking fights with strikers and brandishing firearms, and in some cases, threatening citizens who had no connection with Real Silk or the strike. Not long after, Michael F. Morrissey, chief of the Indianapolis Police Department, issued a statement noting his belief that the people of Indianapolis may work and leave employment whenever and however they want, as long as it was peaceful. He also stated that he believed he had sufficient manpower to protect the city, and he would, quote, "be the first person to ask the mayor and the Board of Public Safety for additional men," end quote. Chief Morrissey further reported that he had informed Real Silk that Warren Township Deputy Constable credentials, which had been issued to 17 Real Silk guards, were illegal and that guards had to stop acting in a constable capacity. Warren Township is a township here in Marion County, and each township would have its constable. Credentials could be handed out through that office. Apparently, a former constable of Warren Township had illegally distributed the credentials to the Real Silk personnel when the strike first began in order to make their anti-strike efforts more legitimate. As the first week of May wore on and the strike entered its third week, the federal government sent two mediators to Indianapolis to seek a resolution of the strike. P.A. Donahue was sent in by the NLB, and Anna Weinstock was sent by the Department of Labor. Annapolis Star reported that Ms. Weinstock had, quote, unusual success as a mediator of strikes in the garment industry, end quote. Both mediators set to work meeting with the opposing sides of the strike, as well as with regional labor officials. Despite these efforts to settle the strike, violence continued. On Thursday, May 3rd, a bomb was detonated at the home of John Madden, who, remember, his brother had his car flipped over at the same residence earlier in the strike, and this was located at 2614 East North Street. The device was placed against the foundation of the home, and when detonated, created a small crater in the ground and broke windows in Madden's home and surrounding structures. There were no injuries, but the Star noted in a story on May 8th that not only was Madden and his family in danger, but the family who shared the other side of the duplex was also put in harm's way. And again, if you go to my blog posting, which will be in the show notes, this home actually still stands, and there's a picture of this house in that blog posting. While street fights and vandalism had been commonplace during the strike, May 7th saw an additional escalation in violence. In one incident, a bus carrying Real Silk employees home was attacked by alleged strikers who threw rocks and bricks at the bus, injuring several. The bus had been under police escort at the time, and in addition to injuries and broken windows, it suffered a flat tire. While the tire was being fixed, another crowd of strikers arrived and moved on the bus, although the police escort prevented them from reaching the vehicle. The bus, with its tire so flat, was taken to a nearby police precinct office and its passengers unloaded and taken indoors for protection while the tire was fixed. Street fights throughout the city were also reported, as was increased vandalism at employee homes. These events, along with the Madden bombing, and there was also a failed bombing attempt at a second employee's house a week later, spurred Real Silk management to post ads in local newspapers decrying the actions of the strikers and pleading for the city and police officers to protect their non-striking workers and property, in addition to offering rewards for information related to the bombings. And there's actually a newspaper article from the Indianapolis Star that in big bold letters says, another $500 reward, second bombing attempt in 10 days. This is going back to the failed attempt. And then it starts talking about viewpoint of the management of the company relating to the bombing. And then at the end it says, there's a growing public feeling that those who are directing the strike could put an end to this violence. Strikes are not settled by force, and public opinion does not support such an un-American method, end quote. So in response to the growing violence, which again wasn't just the strikers, there were also Real Silk employees and as well as Real Silk guards who were still going throughout the city and in some cases picking fights with striking workers. But in response to this violence, Chief Morrissey arrested the strike organizer, William Smith, and declared that his patience was now exhausted and ordered his officers, quote, to meet violence with violence, end quote. In one situation, police set upon some striking employees who were peacefully picketing and opened fire on one picketer as he ran away between some homes. The pistol shots went into nearby homes, narrowly missing several residents. Other reports from the area around the mill indicated individuals not involved with the strike, just merely in the area, were hassled and roughed up by police during Morrissey's offensive. On May 9th, and in the face of aggressive actions from the police, the striking workers obtained an injunction from the Marion County Court against the police to prevent any breaking up of their picket lines. The next day, William Smith, who had been released from jail, and Gustav Efremson were summoned by Indianapolis Mayor Reginald Sullivan, who attempted to mediate the labor dispute. However, after 2 hours of discussion with the mayor, no resolution was reached. Also on that day, the Department of Labor mediator Anna Weinstock left the city to report back to her superiors in Washington. The Indianapolis Star reported that she left, quote, discouraged, end quote, by her lack of success in mediating a settlement. To round out a busy day in strike news, the Indiana Supreme Court also struck down an injunction which had been granted to the strikers by the Marion County Court in regard to the police action over the previous few days. But a possible breakthrough was coming. On May 14th, the parties agreed to participate in negotiations in Washington with the National Labor Board. Both sides selected representatives to attend, and in a show of good faith, the strikers dropped their efforts to revive their injunction against the police. The Annapolis News reported hopefully that, quote, peaceful conditions prevailed in the vicinity of the mill, end quote, as both sides awaited the outcome of the negotiations. During this lull, 11 men were convicted of rioting from the previous outbreaks of violence related to the strike. One woman, Marie Miller, who had been charged with assault and battery during a strike disturbance, had her judgment withheld by the court. On May 22, 1934, an agreement was reached, and the striking workers voted to return to work on May 24th. The terms of the settlement seemed to favor Real Silk, as the IMBA was recognized as a representational body for the Real Silk employees, although a new election was still needed in the fall of 1934. Alexander McCowan, the vice president of the National Union, was quoted in the Times saying that, quote, "It's just one of those damn things. We reached a point where it was impossible to buck the opposition financially. We just took it on the chin," end quote. However, this agreement was limited to just the main Real Silk factory, and the smaller satellite factories in the Indianapolis area retained their previously voted upon union representation. The Indianapolis Times, in an editorial headline, quote, "The strike nobody won," end quote, which was published on May 28, 1934, noted that the resolution did not dive into the substantive issues at hand and merely delayed a determination on the union until later that year. Times opined that strikes are like a fire without insurance, purely destructive, end quote, and observed that, quote, "These incendiaries may be on the side of either capital or labor. In the case of Real Silk, we believe that the fault lay with the stiff-necked and arrogant attitude of the mill's management," end quote. William Smith, the leader of the strike on behalf of the American Federation, was actually forced out of his national secretary position because of the outcome of the strike, although some of the company's employees did later obtain union representation from the American Federation of Full-Fashion Hosiery Workers. Another strike in late 1935 over working hours was averted following a meeting with management and the union to address these grievances. Gustav Ephraimson, owner of Real Silk, would continue to operate the company through the rest of the Great Depression and World War II. Following his death in 1946, Gustav's son, Robert, took over the operations, but would shut down the company's manufacturing facilities in the early 1950s and converted Real Silk into an investment company which he operated until his death. The factory site on Massachusetts Avenue was converted first into a printing operation after Real Silk's closure, and in the early 1990s was converted into the Real Silk Loft Apartments. Already a prominent name in Indianapolis in the 1930s, the Ephraimson family are known for their philanthropy and donations to numerous community projects and causes throughout Indianapolis via the Ephraimson Family Fund. So that is a story of the Real Silk strike. As I noted earlier, or mentioned earlier, there is a blog post associated with this podcast. I'll include a link to that in the show notes. This blog post also contains the various sources that I relied on for this podcast. And again, thank you very much for listening to yesterday's Indianapolis, and I hope you'll listen in the future.